Good morning, 9:13 on a Wednesday morning. It's October 29th. I'm David Giustina, filling in for Sarah LeDuc, who's filling in for Joe Donahue. We've gone down the list now. I don't know who will be next, but you got me today. I apologize for that. But you'll love our panel. They are great people. Founder and academic director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and professor of politics, philosophy, and human rights at Bard College, Roger Berkowitz is here with us. Good morning, sir.
Great to be here. Good morning, David.
Professional speaker, speaking coach, and Albany County legislator. Maybe you can help me with some speaking here. Mark Grimm is here. Hey, Mark.
Glad to help anybody.
All right.
Good to see you, Dave.
Good to see you. Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan is here before the big playground announcement this afternoon.
Yes, we're very excited for the new playground. It was designed by the community for the community, and we're really looking forward to opening it up and seeing it filled with young people having a great time.
And this is Washington Park.
This is Washington
here
Park.
Here in Albany.
Our premier park in Albany.
No question. An associate professor in the Department of Sociology at Vassar College, Catherine Tan, is here. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Well, it's great to have all of you here with us for the discussion. I can remind our listeners, of course, that you can join by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. That's panel@wamc.org. Maybe keep the caps lock off, maybe not 16 paragraphs. Just a couple of points. Our panel can handle it. They will respond once we get to those letters. Also, I want to tell you the music you heard was Spyro Gyra. They're playing at Universal Preservation Hall in Saratoga Springs, New York, tomorrow night. ATUPH.org for more information on that fine music. Well, interesting news this morning. Israel's military says the ceasefire was back on in Gaza after it carried out heavy strikes overnight across the Palestinian territory. Local health officials in Gaza said Wednesday that the strikes killed 104 people, including 46 children. They were the deadliest since the ceasefire was enacted on October 10th and marked the most serious challenge to the tenuous truce to date. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he had ordered the strikes, accusing Hamas of violating the ceasefire when the militant group this week handed over body parts that Israel said were the partial remains of a hostage recovered earlier in the war. So, ceasefire or no ceasefire, how you define that is, I guess, is where we are at this point. But 104 people are dead nonetheless. So, who wants to start this part of the discussion today? Catherine.
this is terrible. I mean, what is the meaning of a ceasefire if it's going to be violated? And, of course, this is not the first time since October 10th that the ceasefire has been violated. What is startling to me is this seems like a very non-urgent, serious issue to start firing, right? This was not in response to an attack. So it seems incredibly disproportionate to what it is that they're responding to, which is the return of human remains. And so if there was delay in that or any sort of stall, firing Gaza seems like such an incredibly disproportionate response and so tragic.
I mean, I think that for anyone in the administration to suggest that there is peace in the Middle East and that Donald Trump was responsible for it, they only need to look at the fact that I think the reports are that there are 100 dead, 45 children, to say that we don't have peace in the Middle East and that what happened, I agree with how Catherine described it. Apparently, a member of the Israeli military was also shot and killed. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the disproportionality there, to me, Netanyahu is just deciding when he's going to attack Gaza. There is no peace there. And people continue to live in fear. There continues to be a humanitarian crisis happening there. And we are seeing, again, this president who serially, as I've said, underestimates the complexity of what is happening around him and what is truly needed to move towards peace. And this is, to me, yet another example of that.
Yeah, I'm curious to how the U.S. is going to respond to this, especially since Trump was so heavily involved in the brokering of the proposal in the ceasefire deal. And at this point, the live hostages have been returned, which is fantastic. But if we're seeing violations of the ceasefire over and over again, already twice in this month alone, what will peace look like and what will rebuilding look like for the people of Gaza?
Mark Grimm.
Well, Hamas is terrible. Let's not forget these people invaded a country and cut the heads off of infants in front of their parents. So they can't be trusted. Now, Israeli troops were attacked, and in fact, one was killed. They're faking bodies because a lot of people are upset. Oh, we're not getting back the dead bodies and understanding. Imagine being a family member. So we don't have peace in the Middle East. We haven't as long as I've been around. Hamas cannot be trusted. So where do you go from there, I guess, for any president is a difficult question.
I agree that they cannot be trusted, and no one is on the side of Hamas. But the people who are getting hurt right now are civilians, right? People who are not necessarily Hamas supporters, or, you know, these are also children who probably have no idea who Hamas is, right? It's awful. And this sort of level of retaliation seems, I mean, from my perspective, really severe and unwarranted for the reason that Netanyahu's.
Well, how would you get rid of Hamas then? Because they're embedded. We know that they're embedded within the population. How would you, and they're committed to killing Israelis because they're Jewish. Mm-hmm. What would you do about it?
Well, I think that this, as we said, the response is disproportionate. Mm-hmm. This is a complex, complicated problem.
Amen.
And we have individuals who are refusing to acknowledge that on all sides there is work that needs to be done, and that on all sides there have been injustices that have occurred throughout the history of this part of the world. And that requires people coming to a table. Mm-hmm. That requires, I am not suggesting that we negotiate with terrorists. Hamas, they're terrorists. But they, too, are creating the opportunity for there to be further divide. We are not working towards peace with the current strikes that Netanyahu continues to play out in Gaza.
Professor.
Excuse me. Yeah, so look, there's a tragic situation. We all know that. I don't love it. I hate it when children are killed. I don't know how many children were killed. I don't know we have any good numbers yet. I think it is important to remember that, as Mark said, Hamas is a terrible organization. And for all people don't like Donald Trump, you know, he's made a decision that in order to get peace, you're going to have to get rid of Hamas. Is that a correct decision? I think it is, but you know, we can argue over it. The problem is that Hamas is using this current ceasefire to reconstitute itself, and it's delaying on purpose. It's, you know, we have to understand the two things that led to this particular attack. One is they went into an area and they buried remains of a hostage that had already been returned because they only gave partial remains. Then they dug it up and presented those as the remains of a different hostage. We have this on tape of them doing this. It's pretty, you know, it's pretty cynical. On the other hand, they also fired on Israeli troops and killed a soldier. You know, I just have to think, what would the United States do if an organization killed one of our soldiers? We would bomb them. I'm not justifying killing civilians. I don't like that. I think it's terrible. But this is, you know, the part of the peace deal is that the Saudis and Qatar and other Arab nations will send in peace troops or to govern Gaza. Well, they've been very clear. They are not going to send in troops if Hamas is in control, because no one wants to deal with Hamas, not even the Saudis and the Qatar. So what's happening here is Hamas is intentionally delaying the return of the hostages. They're delaying it so that they can reconstitute their power in Gaza. And, you know, I don't have a great solution. I don't like the idea of bombing from, you know, 100,000 feet, whatever, 20,000 feet, and where, you know, where it's indiscriminate killing. I think it's terrible. And I think what's happening there is a tragedy. But it's hard. I do agree with Kathy that there is not peace there. I think there's too many people on the ground on both sides who don't want peace. And it's going to be incredibly hard. That said, I think we have to give some credit where credit is due. We're closer to peace and at least have a ceasefire than we've been in over 2 years. And I think that's at least a positive situation.
Well, Vincent has checked in at panel@wamc.org. It's a very short, brief comment. This is Trump's, quote, mission accomplished moment.
He got what he wanted and walked away.
Well, listen, this thing's been going on for decades. Yeah. There is no easy fix. And at least we had some ceasefire for some time. That's better than war all
for
the time.
For days.
Oh, and this he hasn't walked away.
This is what this president does. He sows the seeds of disaster to me everywhere he goes. He walks in and he claims that he has brought peace to the Middle East, and he hasn't. He hasn't even come close to it. We do not have a ceasefire. It does not exist.
Technically, we do right now.
Okay, technically, how? You just said Hamas fired on the Israelis and the Israelis bombed Hamas and Gaza. That's not a ceasefire.
And by the way, we should say that Israel informed the United States ahead of time that they were going to respond, and the United States approved it. And what they said is, and the, you know, both Marco Rubio and J.D. Vance, like, I hate the Trump administration. I'm not trying to, but in this case, I think they've done a pretty good job. They basically said, look, if there's going to be a ceasefire, Hamas is going to have to abide by it. And if they don't, they're going to be destroyed. And I think that's the kind of, if you're going to have a ceasefire, you're going to need that kind of force in order to enforce it. Now, if you know, don't want to destroy Hamas, that's another idea. But I do think that that there is not going to be any kind of ceasefire as long as Hamas keeps reconstituting itself.
We've got another letter, this from Matt, who says, Hamas did not cut the heads off of babies. Netanyahu thinks it's okay to kill children. There will almost certainly not be peace for generations so long as others of that generation survive and almost epigenetically seek revenge. Hamas is terrible, but again, they say they did not cut the heads off infants.
Well, they did.
They did. I don't understand that comment at all.
I mean, that's just misinformation.
Yep.
Well, is this it? We have no solution, do we?
Yeah, that's where we are.
Well, there's not been a solution for 70 years.
There's four of us with no solution, but, you know.
No.
I mean, I think this, I mean, you have to get Qatar and Saudi Arabia and other Arab countries to get involved. You're only going to do that if you can somehow pacify the area. I'm not sure if that's possible or not, but that's what I think the goal has to be, and bring a larger Arab involvement into the area.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it's important to punctuate what Kathy was saying, that, you know, the reality is, in practice, there is no ceasefire right now. It's great that the 20 live hostages got to return home. And now what's going on is people are using the human remains point as a flimsy excuse to take lives, right? To destroy more lives, continue destruction. And you're right, there has to be intervention with other countries coming together.
And by the way, Hamas has denied that it killed that soldier. Mm-hmm. They have said that that was not a member of Hamas, apparently was a sniper. The Israeli soldier. And so when you think about it's a complex situation. And for those who are just devastated by the humanitarian crisis that's mm-hmm. happening in Gaza, I think that this is yet another blow to any hope that people have of literally saving people from starvation mm-hmm. and protecting innocent people who just want to live their lives.
What about what Bob says? He says, there's something here, I think. When there are school shootings, the police separate the innocents from the shooters. They don't bomb the school. Israel is bombing Gaza because it's safer than putting troops on the ground to dig out the militants. Face it, Netanyahu doesn't give a damn about Gazan children.
And I think that it can be understood that there are people who feel that way. That, you know, the use of the word genocide is one that I think is a very loaded term. And I, for one, don't think that it helps to allow us to find a path forward in this situation. But for those who are experiencing it, I can certainly understand that when they see the apparent disproportionality of this response. And let's not forget, I mean, Israel has some of the most incredible surveillance and intelligence tools anywhere in the world. You know, police forces, militaries from all over the world go to Israel to study what they do and their technology. And so for those who say there is a different path, as this listener has suggested, I think that they're absolutely right and that we should be demanding more discretion, you know, more targeted responses to deal with Hamas.
You're listening to the Roundtable panel. With us today is Roger Berkowitz, Mark Grimm. You just heard Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan. Catherine Tan is with us as well. You can join the discussion by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. That's panel@wamc.org. We've got to go away for a little bit of news, and we'll be back soon. And .933 on a Wednesday morning. You're listening to the Roundtable panel on WAMC. I'm David Gustina, filling in for Sarah LeDuc, who's filling in for Joe Donahue. And nothing says Talk Gaza than Spyro Gyra, that very pleasant jazz music. Suddenly felt so out of place to me. But in any case, you can find out more because Spyro Gyra is playing Universal Preservation Hall in Saratoga Springs, New York, tomorrow night, atuph.org. And as always, our playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. Again, you can email us and get into the discussion at panel@wamc.org. We're going to move on from the situation in Gaza to talk about something that the mayor of Albany reminded me has had a bit of a development and would like to talk a little bit more about this. Northeastern leaders are speaking out about President Donald Trump's decision to end federal funding for SNAP. That's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Vermont, New York, Connecticut, and Massachusetts have signed on to a multi-state lawsuit challenging the move, with signatories described as unlawful. 40 million Americans rely on the benefits. Democratic Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell said that over a million Commonwealth residents depend on SNAP. Democratic New York Governor Kathy Hochul said 3 million New Yorkers depend on the program. And Republican Vermont Governor Phil Scott said he had directed his administration to support legal efforts to reinstitute SNAP, saying it will disrupt the lives of 63,000 Vermonters and could cause real harm. And that's just the question I asked you, Mayor Sheehan. How many Albany County residents will be impacted if nothing happens on before Saturday?
Well, the county executive spoke about this, I believe, yesterday, and I believe the number was around 37,000 people, including thousands of children. You know, that's a little more than 10% of the residents just in Albany County. And I heard a statistic. I haven't been able to verify it, but it was that for every one meal that our food pantries provide, SNAP benefits and other benefits provide 9 meals. Our food pantries cannot make up this gap.
And to that point, Natasha Pernicka was here on the roundtable this week saying just that, including that the state of New York really hasn't added any additional funding. They've just got the $41 million that was already allocated that they're pushing out to hopefully make up some of the difference, but it won't make all the difference.
Oh, it won't even come close. I mean, this will have a devastating impact. And I think that for mayors from, I believe it at last count, it was 25 states to be seeking to bring legal action. I mean, the Department of Agriculture said that they could reprogram money and continue to fund SNAP in the shutdown. The Trump administration is making the decision not to do it. They are making the decision to allow millions of people including children, to go hungry.
Claiming it that it's illegal to do that, right?
And this is why this lawsuit is being brought. And maybe there will be reprieve in the courts. Maybe the courts will order the Department of Agriculture to fund SNAP until the case is fully litigated. But again, you know, budgets are documents that show who you are, mm-hmm. and what your values are. And this is a president whose values tell millions of Americans, you're going to go hungry because I'm going to play this political game. And I don't care. And I don't know what other message people could take from that. To me, this is something that it's inhuman. You think about the time of year that this is, mm-hmm. And you know, going into the holiday season, it gets getting cold. People need to pay for heat, mm-hmm. and now they have to worry about whether or not they're going to be able to put food on the table.
There's also the healthcare costs.
And I will say, you know, this is an area where, you know, I'm a Democrat, but being a mayor is a very nonpartisan job. And I look at Republican mayors that I know across the state and across the country. And to a person, I think of Jared Cram, the mayor of Binghamton. He is somebody who is fighting for affordable housing in his community. He's fighting to keep SNAP benefits for people in his community, because we see the impacts of what happens when Washington takes these values that matter to people and plays political games with them. And so I commend my fellow mayors who are out there speaking on this, irrespective of what party they're from, because this is just wrong.
What? Yeah, I talk about political games. The Democrats are playing it in Washington now. We can't continue a resolution which doesn't add money, doesn't cut money, was passed by the Republicans. And the Schumer shut down because they see this as an angle. And, of course, it's complicating all of these social services with the government shut down. It shouldn't be shut down, and we should open it up back up today. Also, one of the problems with social services, waste, fraud, and abuse. There's no question that goes on. We had a circumstance where a hotel in Colony and a hotel in Rotterdam kicked out all the American citizens. They said, get out. Some of them were single moms with kids. And what happened was non-citizens were put in there and at government expense. So the idea that the Democrats let so many non-citizens in, that's eating away at the pie of social services, which is large. Nobody wants to see hungry children. But the reality is, it's one thing to pass a budget. It's another thing to see that it gets to the people that are.
Well, and the Democrats, look, you know, these Republican talking points, I think, are what really infuriate people. And we have to stop with this partisanship. We have Yep. Democrats in Washington who are fighting for people's health care and who are saying to Republicans, hey, you know, you've got this $450 billion tax cut for the wealthiest Americans, and it costs $40 billion to keep health care affordable for the average working family. We need to sit at the table and figure out how to have a compromise. But because we're playing party politics and adding partisanship to this, we're not having those conversations. People are not doing their jobs. And this idea of waste, fraud, and abuse, nobody wants waste, fraud, and abuse. But what I hear when I hear that as an excuse for not funding SNAP, what I hear is we're willing to allow 10 million people to go hungry because 100 people might be cheating. Mm-hmm. And that's just not okay. There are other ways for us to address waste, fraud, and abuse.
Well, Mayor, you've taken just about every chance you can to attack Trump, and then you said how non-partisan you are. The fact of the matter is the Democrats are obsessed with Trump hating, and it's getting in the way of the government.
I'm not, though. And my
fellow
mayors are not. I am criticizing policies. I'm not criticizing the person. And I'm not labeling that person as a Democrat or a Republican. I'm looking at what they're doing. And I'm calling it out. I do not believe that we should be taking people off the streets without due process. Mm-hmm. That's a policy decision. I'm not looking to demonize that person, but we have to talk about the underlying policy decisions that we're making and how they impact the average American family. We all have jobs to do. We're elected to represent people and to keep our streets safe, to keep them clean, to make sure that people can afford housing, to make sure that those who are struggling have an opportunity to ensure that they can move themselves forward. You think about workforce development, all of the things that government does to help people. And those are the things that I wish we were talking about, not this, you know, I hear you, and I don't subscribe to those who just want to hate on someone. We have to be willing, though,
to
talk.
The Vikings calling, sorry.
We have to be willing to talk about the underlying policy decisions that we're going to make to move this country forward.
Well, a big part of that, though, is non-citizens getting government assistance.
It's less than 1%. And so, yes, let's talk about that. So what I would love to see, and what mayors across the country want to see, is common sense immigration reform.
Well, what was your
position?
You're
in control of the House, you're in control of the Senate, and you're in control of the presidency. And you could pass rules that are easy to understand, that provide due process to people, that give people the opportunity to understand how to navigate. I'm going to tell you right now, woe to me if I had to navigate the immigration system in this country. Mm-hmm. Because you have families that are here where the husband has one status, the wife has another status, the children have another status, and if you fill out the wrong date on a form, you're going to be kicked out of the country. It makes no sense to people. So, it's inhumane. So let's fix it.
What was your position then?
Let's not demonize people.
When they kicked American citizens out of those hotels and they put non-citizens there and they paid for their benefits, what was your position on that?
Well, I disagree with the underlying premise and the facts that you've laid out. And so
you're saying there weren't non-citizens in those hotels?
I am saying, of course, there were non-citizens in those hotels. You know what? Non-citizens stay in some of the nicest hotels in New York City, too. They come here to visit. You know, let's not demonize people.
We're not demonizing.
Our tourism industry depends on non-citizens.
There's a limited pie.
Who come here. Yes.
And you can say, we want more money for this and that. There's a limited pie in that you go to the American citizens who are most in need. No Republican is for a hungry child. And anyone who suggests that doesn't know what they're talking
about.
Well,
then fun snap.
Is that pie? I mean, how big is that pie? Is that a huge pie compared to some of the corporate welfare that goes out or the Defense Department? I mean, you're talking about crumbs for the poor. Yeah. Crumbs.
Yeah. And there's
compared to what the greatest government in human history, the greatest country in the world, but we can't take care of
people. And by the way, and I don't like this term of, let's not otherize people.
Yeah.
People, immigrants who are here in this country are taxpayers.
Mm-hmm.
They buy food. They purchase, they pay sales tax. They rent apartments. They're paying the property taxes for the owner of that building.
They do jobs other people don't want to do.
But they're denied benefits.
But they're denied benefits, exactly. And so, again, when we otherize people and we demonize people, I want my community to be safe. I don't want someone in my community who is a threat to my community. And so I want common sense immigration reform so that people understand the pathway into this country. We need immigrants. We desperately need immigrants. I don't talk to a single small business owner who doesn't say we need more, we need workforce.
Mm-hmm.
So let's figure out how to do it, not demonize and otherize people. It's inhumane.
Deep breath. Everybody inhale.
It's inhumane.
Exhale. Yeah. We're all American citizens in this room, and we're going to continue our discussion. We're going to take a break. We'll let Mark weigh in. We'll let Professor Berkowitz weigh in, and we'll let Catherine Tan weigh in. All right? We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. Wednesday morning, 9:46. You're listening to the Roundtable panel on WAMC. I'm David Gustina here because I have to be. And, look, it's getting hot in this room. It's not easy. You know what happens. People get in sort of an argument, then you get a little uncomfortable. But we're all grown-ups here. We can still have a conversation. Right, Mark?
I'm not uncomfortable at all. I love debating. I wish we could do more of it.
Well, you're part of this panel, and I appreciate your side of things, quite frankly. And it's good to have someone who's not afraid to argue. What else you want to say about this particular topic?
Well, I think the major points have been noted. But to reiterate, this is a public health issue. This is an ethical issue. we need to protect the most vulnerable in this country. And by cutting something like SNAP and by cutting things like other welfare programs, we're not serving our citizens. This administration is not serving its citizens. And look at what is being funded, right? We've been talking a lot about what's not being funded. What is being funded? Look at all of the money that has been moved towards ICE and picking up immigrants in the United States. Earlier in the administration, they were talking about, well, striking down on people who are known criminals and who are violent. But those are not the people who are getting picked up, right? These are hardworking people who are just trying to make a life for their family. And, you know, that's what we're putting our money into. We're putting money into having, you know, troops on the ground in cities for no real good reason. Meanwhile, we're depriving the most vulnerable of basic necessities.
And we're also calling crime riddled communities in Chicago and all these cities. Now let's take all the benefits away from the poorest. What do you think that's going to cause?
Exactly.
So it's really important for us to remember that there is still a center in the United States, right? Most people still believe, more or less, polls show capitalism is with a welfare state is better than socialism. Most people believe that you don't want immigrants simply taken off the streets in a lawless manner. I mean, one of my students, Ali Farkhrizada, was just arrested coming out of a hearing where the judge said you're about to get asylum 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, we reported on that very story this morning.
And it's, you know, I mean, the what's happening in Chicago where, you know, you're throwing tear gas canisters and going into communities and intentionally trying to provoke people and rile them up. You know, this is stuff that we don't want. That said, most people do believe that you should have legal ways of coming into this country as immigrants.
But how does it work when they have, like, ICE waiting outside the courthouses when people are trying to take the legal route and they're getting in trouble for it?
Well,
and,
okay.
and these are civil
if
rules.
If I can't.
They're not criminal.
No. Let Professor Berkowitz finish.
Yeah, I think so.
I was trying to say, I think that people who have, I think what Ali Farkhrizada was doing was completely illegal, and I think it's completely wrong that he was arrested. We have a situation, I think, you know, on SNAP where most people, I think almost, you know, most Americans believe that people who are unfortunate enough to need it and not be able to afford food should get benefits. And, you know, there is this center. Why is it not holding? There's rampant partisanship in this country. Obviously, it's nothing new. It's built by a number of things. One is gerrymandering, the unbelievable gerrymandering that has gone on over the last decades has made it so that over 90% of House districts are safe districts in which the people who are elected then are the most radical people from their primaries.
This is both parties,
and this is both parties
not
now.
One party.
And
they
by
both
the
want to make advantage for themselves.
And they both have done it, although we should admit that in a number of states, there has been a good governance movement that's tried to tackle this, and that's so these are important problems that both parties are at fault. What the Democrats did over many years, what the Republicans did, I don't think it's that different. I think it is important to say that the Trump administration has come in and played a political hardball in a way that has not been seen in American history. The attack on the separation of powers, the attack on the taking away, the defunding of programs funded by Congress, the firing of independent agency heads, the brutal use of ICE to enforce to basically arrest people who are here legally. I mean, I am all for enforcement of immigration laws. But when people like Ali Farkhrizada, who are doing things legally, are arrested, and then if a state like California or Portland says we're going to arrest agents who are breaking the law by throwing tear gas canisters, the federal government now threatens them with arrest because federal supremacy. This kind of blatant and not to mention the gerrymandering, the blatant mid-decade gerrymandering that is being seen and going on. And so I think the government shutdown, you know, is a very complicated issue because on the one hand, the Democrats, you know, as Mark rightly said, are playing politics, but they feel they have no choice. And And this is the situation we're in. We're in a kind of nuclear brinkmanship politics mm-hmm. now, where both sides feel they have no choice, and the little people are getting screwed. And there seems to be almost no way out of it without capitulating to Trump. Trump won't capitulate. He'll never back down. The Democrats don't want to capitulate. And it's a game of chicken. And that's the situation we're in. And it's a tragic situation. You would really wish that we could have a government that would actually work for the people.
You know, there was a Siena poll that was long-term poll that looked at the country and all sides of the spectrum and how they felt about politics. And the one thing everybody agreed on is that they were mad at Washington. They were mad at the way the Washington politicians were going about their business and they weren't doing things right. And you can see that plays out and why Trump was so brilliant to say, oh, I know how that works. I know how to rig the system myself when he was in the debate with Hillary. And he wasn't wrong that people see the system is rigged and that if you got the money, you can go ahead and rig it for yourself. And that appealed to a lot of people. And I think both Democrats and Republicans who are not in those upper echelons feel that. They feel there is no way to get a leg up in this country.
I agree with you, David. And I hate to say this, but I don't think it's going to get better until it gets a lot worse. Mm. There's got to be a crisis. You know, the Democrats are going to need to break in a sense that the Democrats who continue to hold on to the status quo and the day of going back to what came before are going to have to break, and you're going to have to bring a new kind of Democrat into power. Or a new party. I don't know what it's going to be. The Republican Party has been completely taken over by Trump and MAGA. That's clear. And unfortunately, I think the Democratic Party is in danger of being taken over by by the people who are left, which are largely upper middle class, downwardly mobile white people who highly educated. And the result is that the center is left without a party. And that's what I fear is happening in this country. And until somehow one of the parties breaks and moves to the center and tries to recapture the center, or a new party is created, I don't know what it's going to be. I don't see this political gamesmanship that really, sacrifices the individuals to their political power dreams ending. And it's sad.
Well, but you wonder what the country will look like. I mean, I think anybody who believes that we have due process in this country isn't paying attention. I think that we don't have due process.
Can I ask you a question about that or not? I don't want to interrupt you.
Sure.
I mean, so Ali Farrakhzadeh is in detention, right? He was arrested. We are fighting. Bard has enlisted lawyers. We're fighting it. There is due process. There is a legal system. I think it's being abused intentionally by ICE. But the judges are there. I mean, in fact, the judge in Chicago just today required that Bovino come and give daily reports. I agree with you that ICE and the president is trying to flood the courts and do so in a way that puts due process in danger. But I don't like the rhetoric of there's no due process.
Well, because,
because there is due process. A lot of these people who've been in prison have been let out.
But a lot of people have also been deported to countries they're not even originally
right.
from.
Yeah,
African countries have been taking advantage of this situation, agreeing to take whoever we deport, and a lot of people get lost in the system.
There are people getting lost, and I agree with that. But the point is there is still a legal system, and we should support it and fight it and fight with it as much as possible.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting that we don't fight within the legal system, and that's why I applaud the lawsuits that are being brought, for example, this latest one by the governors around SNAP. But you have a high-profile case where there are people watching and working to ensure that mm-hmm. due process occurs. For millions of people, they do not have that same support. And we don't know. For people that were put on planes and sent to other countries, we have no idea what process that they were given. We know certainly that there are dozens of people who are dead in both the Caribbean and the Pacific because they were blown up in boats mm-hmm. that, for whatever reason, we decided were carrying drugs. We didn't arrest the individuals. We didn't interdict and seize them. We blew them up and killed them
on a suspicion.
And so to me, I can't see. So if we can justify that, mm-hmm. you know, do we, what is next? Who is the next other group?
American citizens versus people in Venezuela. I happen to agree with you. I think it's, I think what the Trump administration is doing, blowing up the votes in Venezuela, is a violation of international law. But it's different from a violation of American law and constitutional rights. I mean, let's just, I think it's important to keep that distinction.
Understood. And I think that when you look at the way decisions are being made, this is an administration that is showing us what their values are.
Absolutely.
The values are law and order. We have sanctuary. Oh, yeah. I guess you're against law and order. Okay.
Well, I don't see this as law and order.
I mean, ICE members are being called Nazis, for heaven's sakes. Yeah. This kind of nonsense.
Can they uncover their faces?
The attacks on ICE officers have skyrocketed. I'd want to wear a mask under those circumstances of my life and the lives of my family.
Well, look, I was not supporting Palestinian activists on campus either, but when they wore masks, the Republicans went crazy. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If you live in a democratic society, you should show your face and you should take responsibility for what you do. That's part of the basic small R Republican values of self-government and responsibility.
But this is rhetoric that this is the end of democracy. We hear this over and over again. Really? Because we've had three votes on Trump. He won twice. He lost once. So, you know, is he a king? Well, he won two elections. We see these no king rallies, although, you know, by the way, Trump lost a vote in the Senate yesterday. And if he really was a king, we wouldn't have people wouldn't be able to protest.
So I agree.
So they could protest anything they want. That's
I agree with Mark
is.
That it's not the end of democracy. I disagree with him because while I think that there is a law and order problem in the country, and I actually think that in some cases Trump is actually right that we need more law and order. Like, I think, like, you know, there was an article today that in Nashville people are happy to have the National Guard. If people want the National Guard, you know, I don't have a problem with that. But there is a real problem when, and this is where I agree with Kathy, if, you know, the fact that Ali Farrakhzada is able to, has Bard College working for him and is thus able to mobilize congressional representations, senators, lawyers, et cetera. And we basically have to be like, please, please let him go. This is about flattery of individuals. It's not about the rule of law. And that's the way we're headed, and that's not law and order.
We've got to take a break. We'll be back. That's the end of our show today. We're just going to go away and have breakfast. What do you say, guys? That just made me feel a lot more relaxed, brought my temperature down about 100 degrees. Here we are. It's the roundtable panel on WAMC 1007. Here with a great group of people. We have Roger Berkowitz. We have Mark Grimm. We have Kathy Sheehan, Mayor of Albany, and Catherine Tan with us, all discussing important issues. You can join us by emailing us at panel@wamc.org. And that wonderful music with Spyro Gyra playing Universal Preservation Hall in Saratoga Springs, New York tomorrow night, atuph.org for more info. And, of course, our playlist is posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. Back to the discussion, folks. Let's see where we go on this one. From the Associated Press this morning, the Senate approved a resolution Tuesday night that would nullify President Donald Trump's tariffs on Brazil, including oil, coffee, and orange juice, as Democrats test GOP senators' support for Trump's trade policy. The legislation from Democratic Virginia Senator Tim Kaine passed by a vote of 52-48 with five Republicans joining the Democrats. The legislation would terminate the national emergencies that Trump has declared to justify the tariffs. Kaine is planning similar resolutions applying to Trump's tariffs on Canada and other nations. However, the legislation is likely doomed because the Republican-controlled House has passed new rules that allow leadership to prevent it from ever coming up for a vote. Who wants to go first?
Well, I mean, to me, it's a ray of hope of showing that, you know, at least the Senate is willing to do their job and not cede power to the president that is given to Congress. I'm not optimistic that the House will follow and do the same thing. But I do think that, you know, people are very troubled by the current on-again, off-again tariff policy of the United States. And we elect people to Congress to represent us and to weigh in on important issues like this. And I think that this is a sign that there are some who are willing to step up and say this is something that we as elected officials, as senators, have a say in, and we need to, you know, focus on what we think is right for the country.
It was strange that there was a tariff in place at all to begin with, because didn't we already have a a trade surplus with Brazil? So in this agreement, they were already purchasing a lot of stuff from us. So it made no sense why we had one in place at all, other than it's another example of Trump just acting on his emotions, because from my understanding, this tariff was put in place because he disagreed with the prosecution of his buddy Bolsonaro. And, you know, it's incredible how these big decisions are being deployed and governed by one man's emotions. It really shows how how unsteady these tariffs are, and we've seen it fluctuate for other countries as well. It's just sort of what are Trump's vibes today, right? How is he feeling about this particular country or this particular politician? It's all really unsettling how it's not based on rational economic sense.
Yeah, I mean, the Congress has the right to tax and has the right to institute tariffs. The president has claimed this right in this case and many others on basis of national security. It's a tenuous claim in many cases, because the idea that we have a trade surplus or a trade deficit is not clearly national security, but that's going through the courts and we'll see what the Supreme Court decides. Mm-hmm. But in this particular case, as Catherine said, there's no trade deficit. In fact, there's a trade surplus, and it was clearly simply to punish Brazil for prosecuting Mr. Bolsonaro. It is a ray of hope, I think, is one of them, one someone said, but the idea that only five senators from the Republican Party, and look, to me, this is a nonpartisan issue. The very premise of the United States government is that we have a separation of powers. And if the Congress refuses to fight for its powers, right, in Federalist 51, Madison said that it will be protected by the fact that each part of the government will fight and be ambitious and greedy for its own powers. If they refuse to fight for their own powers, then there's nothing the Supreme Court do or other people can do to stop it. And to me, yeah, tariffs are, you know, maybe an issue, but the real issue here is separation of powers and the idea of a unitary executive idea, theory of the government, which says that the executive can do whatever the hell they want. If Congress doesn't fight back, you know, we will end up with a kind of personal, whether it's a king or whether it's a constitutional dictator or a democratic dictator, which, by the way, is a real thing. And to me, this is an essential problem. And why only five senators were willing to vote for it, to me, is sort of a shanda. And the fact that the House won't even consider it is a double shanda. So I find it still pretty depressing that Congress cannot get its act together, although maybe it is a ray of hope.
Well, on tariff policy, if one country is charging you a 20% tariff, you should be able to charge them a 20% tariff. So, because...
Mark, this has nothing to do with that in this case.
No, it's about tariff policy, okay?
But we're not talking about that in the case of Brazil. Well, Let's just be honest.
I'll get to that. I agree with this tariff policy that no president has really had the nerve to enforce, frankly. All these countries are taking advantage of. If they're charging a 20% tariff on us, we should be able to charge a 20% tariff on them. Now, Brazil's a different story, because his issue is he has someone in Venezuela, a leader that he wants to support, so he's going to have a tariff to do it. Trump's a bull in a
China shop,
and this is kind of an example, and that's why five senators raised their hands and said, I can't support it. I mean, they were the usual suspects, Rand Paul and Murkowski and whatever. But I agree that, especially with the surplus we have, is quite large with Brazil. That's what we want. Ideally, we'd like to have a surplus with every country. But the problem, I mean, I don't want to confuse the two. The tariff policy, I think, is long overdue, to make it fair for the United States, which is taken advantage of. But the Brazil one doesn't work for.
But where do you
reasons.
Stand on the separation of powers and the power of
well,
Congress?
Well, that's for the courts to decide. I mean,
no, it's for Congress to decide.
No, wait, no, president.
It's actually for the Congress
their executive
to decide.
Authority. They push their executive authority.
And
to
Congress
the
should resist.
And Congress can resist. Well, and I think you know I agree that we need sound policies on trade, but Congress is supposed to be part of that, and they're supposed to be at the table. And I realize this isn't the first president to push executive authority. This has been happening over Democratic presidents and Republican presidents. Yep. I think that what we see and why people can be forgiven for referring to this president as a king is the very type of sort of rash action that Catherine talked about. I don't want you prosecuting my friend, and so I'm going to slap a tariff on you. When
I don't like that you ran a negative ad against
right.
my tariff policy,
against
Canada.
My tariff policy.
You're back on the list.
I'm putting you back on the list. And,
nonsense.
And look, he has surrounded himself by people who you need to listen very carefully to what they're saying. You know, in response to the criticisms around the ceasefire, you had a vice president saying President Trump's peace plan is working. When new immigration policies were floated about new rules that would prefer people from majority white countries coming here, it was said we are going to allow people in who are aligned with President Trump's values, not American values. They did not use the word American values. Mm. They used the words President Trump's values. So people could be forgiven if they are concerned that we are moving towards a use of executive authority that truly is unprecedented.
Nothing? That's it?
I agree.
Mark.
Well, I think, you know, the tariff policy is something that's taken courage. And he also, you know, he's a world negotiator. He's been in business, international business, a long time. But I don't agree with everything Trump does. People... I hear, Trump MAGA people that, you know, we don't have minds of our own. So I'm not a Trump MAGA person. Trump couldn't have got elected with just the Trump MAGA crowd. They're a minority crowd. The fact of the matter, he won two elections. In the last election, he won all seven swing states, which hasn't happened in a while. So Trump has a lot more supporters than people think. They're just afraid to speak up because they'll get shouted at the grocery store if they're wearing a MAGA hat.
Well, Rand Paul did say that when he was asked why other senators are not voting to protect the Senate's authority, he said because they're afraid. So talk about I agree with you that some Trump supporters were afraid for a long time. There was a cancel culture on the left, but the cancel culture on the right now is much worse and much more destructive.
Well, I don't agree with that, but I salute your opinion, my good man.
How about that? We have at least that agreement here this morning. Panel at WAMC.org. We are here with Mark Grimm, who you just heard. Also, Professor Bard College, Roger Berkowitz. We have Mayor Kathy Sheehan of Albany and Associate Professor of the Department of Sociology at Vassar College, Catherine Tan. You want to have just a little fun for 1 minute? Because I have a question for you, Albany Mayor. I love this. I read this almost every day. Support for WAMC comes from the City of Albany and Mayor Kathy Sheehan announcing special events and adventures in the City of Albany. Something to do in Albany.us for details. Come on, you know you're taking a shot at Rebecca Lobo.
Well, you know, I've been clapping back for a while. And, you know, when I'm at Alive at 5 or at, you know, a great event in the Warehouse District or, you know, at the Palace Theater or at Cap Rep, you know, I do in my head say, oh, if only good luck finding something to do in Albany.
Yes, yes. That's what Rebecca, maybe people yeah. might won't remember, but this was the NCAA, and I believe, what's her name? Clark was there, right?
Yes, Caitlin Clark. Caitlin? We had sold out. It was a great vibe in downtown. It was Easter weekend, and it was a Sunday, so,
yes.
you know.
And one of the players, I think it was Reese, told her friends and family, you know, I need to prepare for this game.
Yeah.
You go out and enjoy yourself, yeah. which prompted Rebecca, good luck finding something to do in Albany. Now you have a whole ad campaign about it.
Well, you know, you got to lean into it. But, you know, we're really excited about the investment that's happening. Look, you know, Albany did not come back from the pandemic the way that we had hoped. Mm-hmm. And we had thought that because we were a capital city, a lot of state workers, that we would bounce back. I know mayors from cities across the country whose downtowns still have not bounced back because people commute to work. They're only here 2 days a week, three days a week. But of course, not surprisingly, the state workforce has followed suit, right? The state has to compete for workforce as well. And so to the governor's credit, recognizing that, you know, we're their corporate headquarters, so to speak, the investment that's being made in downtown to ensure, you know, we had already done a lot of residential conversions of office buildings to residential. That all happened through the pandemic. All of those apartments are full, but we need more. And so
let's tax the complex.
Well, looking at, you know, the ability to build, you know, 500 to 1,000 new units of housing downtown, really focusing on our small businesses. I'm excited for the future. I look forward to what the next mayor will be able to do with that $200 million.
I couldn't help it, but I do think of that when I read that.
And as someone who lives downtown, you know, we were talking a little bit about sending in the National Guard for public safety. You know, public safety is a complex issue. And I think Catherine touched on it when she talked about, you know, eliminating SNAP benefits and, you know, the layer upon layer of challenges that we see. You know, when we look in Albany, what drives most homicides in the city of Albany is domestic violence. These are people who know each other. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you're not going to solve that by sending in the military. Mm-hmm. And I look at what mayors across the country have done to drive down violence in their cities. And these are multi-pronged strategies. And yes, it involves arresting people and putting them in jail. I do want law and order on my streets. I want violent people taken off of our streets. But there are also lots of other complex issues. We had a homicide in this city that was committed by an individual who had been arrested by the police on a mental health arrest.
Killed his sister, right?
This was an individual who actually killed someone very recently. No, and it was not his sister. He stabbed someone to death. He had been brought to the hospital on a mental health arrest, and he was released within 24 hours, and he committed a homicide. This is somebody who should have been in a mental hospital. So you think about the complexity of these issues, and it takes serious people working together to ensure that we're keeping our community safe. So I, for one, there are times when sending in the National Guard, if there's an emergency, if there's a flood, we've had the National Guard respond when we had an avalanche that dammed up the creek, Patroon Creek. So there are times when the National Guard is welcome, and they're trained to do certain things very, very well. But policing our streets is not one of them in a day-to-day type of environment. And so that is something that you see a lot of mayors pushing back on. Those that are welcoming them, I'm sure, are coordinating with them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but that needs to be a local rule decision.
But also, we've got a big crime issue in New York State because of the legislature. They passed a series of laws that really put more criminals on the street. That's the bottom line. I'm talking discovery, bail reform, raise the age. D.A. Soares actually came to us at one meeting. He said, one of the
former district attorney,
former DA, 16 or 17, he pulled a woman out of her car and carjacked the car and apparently had a gun while he was doing it. But because she couldn't specifically identify the gun, he was referred to family court. This is how crazy it gets. And, you know, family court is nowhere near what the criminal system is. So we have too many people that commit crimes and are back on the streets. And you know what? They commit more crimes, you know, again and again and again. And we just need more sensible legislation that doesn't put so much emphasis on the criminal and then leaves the victim hanging. And until that changes, we're going to be – and we also need more police in Albany.
I think we have to
– I'm just finished. The sheriff's department has invested a lot of their people in the city of Albany to get guns, and they've done quite a job doing it. By the way, that's – county taxpayers are paying for that, helping Albany.
And by the way, can I just remind you that the city of Albany is in Albany County, and we pay Albany County taxes.
Well, but there are other instances where if we provide EMS service or something like that, we charge back the municipalities that the county provides.
And the sheriff is here by his choice.
But he said he would like the money reimbursed, and that's never happened. And we proposed that the Albany reimburse us for the money, but that never happened. But the reality is there's a New York State – I wish Mayor Sheehan would spend more time with her state legislators explaining what the impacts are in her city for the state laws that had been passed.
Well, and we've done that, and we've seen significant amendments to both raise the age and bail reform. We've also seen the judges and the court system really taking a hard look at how a lot of those cases were being adjudicated to address the very issues that you're talking about. And so we are seeing judges, and again, these are decisions that judges are making, but we have seen judges remanding juveniles at a much higher rate because our new DA, I think, has been very effective in how he's presenting these cases and the very issues that you talked about. We don't want people who brandish guns, who have guns on our streets.
And the judge has the discretion.
And so they are remanding, though, into detention far more juveniles. I see it. And our police department is cooperating and working with the DA to make sure that that happens.
Which was part of the argument, I think, appropriately from the Republicans, was to give those judges their discretion back.
Yeah. Although there's some judges are more for law and order than other judges.
Well, I hear what you're saying.
I want to pay more attention to that. But the reality is, yes, crime is a multifaceted issue. Social services has to play a role.
Especially when you have
minors
committing crimes.
But there has to be an attitude. The victim has to be protected. And we have a far left New York City delegation that can be very different than some upstate legislators, for sure.
And it's true, victims need to be protected, but greater policing is not the. I mean, and this is even something you said, Mark. It's not the only resource that we have get to that goal.
Sure.
And this is great further arguments for why we should have, more social services and welfares, because why do people commit crime, right? And going upstream and getting to the root of that issue means providing people with the resources they need so that they're not out there committing crime. And I don't think, there are people just sitting around wanting to take resources. But, people generally have a natural desire to find meaning in life and to work. People want to work, right? And I think it's important to provide support to citizens by providing greater support services. And I know earlier you had expressed concerns about people taking advantage of that. There are also plenty of citizens taking advantage of it, too. We can't just say that it's only immigrants who are doing it. But even if there are people who are, let's say, free riding, the benefit that we get from funding these programs like SNAP is so much greater. We as a society, we have so much more to gain from putting these services out there so that people don't have to resort to desperation.
One of the issues I have with social services, and I'm the ranking member on the finance committee for the county, so I cover this pretty closely. I want to hear about our results, constantly about results. What are results? Because certainly some social service programs are more effective than others, and we don't do a good job of measuring that. A classic case I had is one of the groups is coming for us for smoking cessation, and we were spending, I think, $1 million on the program. I said, great. In your history, how many people were smoking in January? How many were smoking in December? Instead of getting a 50-page form, I really want to focus on social services. How many people are dependent in January? How many are independent in December? That's that kind of information we need more of, because if you don't count it, it doesn't count. Because I want social services to be effective, because it helps the person who needs it, but it also helps society, makes us a stronger society, whether we're Democrat or Republican.
Well, the thing that happens with the social services and the Medicare and all these different programs is the comptroller comes out and he does a report. And the Republicans pick up on this all the time. And he says, you can fix this and you can fix this and you should be doing this. And that's not enforceable. And the legislature rarely, if ever, takes up those suggestions.
Yeah.
So we do have people looking at it and saying, here's what we need to do. Anybody else want to weigh in on this? Professor, you haven't said much in a while. I'd like to hear your thoughts.
My view on this is that I think the Democrats cannot cede law and order. I live partly in the Hudson Valley and partly in New York City. There's a way in which we have look the other way for just basic criminality, turnstile jumping, other stuff like that in the city. And I think that makes people feel unsafe and unwell. And I think most people should follow the rules. And so, you know, I think, again, I think there's a general agreement that people should follow the rules. And I think we have to be willing to pay for police and subway police and things like that to actually enforce the rules. On the other hand, I agree with Catherine that, you know, you need social services and you need to provide people with meaning. I actually would love to see, you know, the loneliness epidemic, which is something I write a lot about, is I don't think it's just financial that causes people to become antisocial and break the rules. I think people feel meaningless and lost. And I would love to see ways in which the governments around the country, mayors, town halls, town councils, brought citizens into the process. So, you know, at the RN Center, we spend a lot of time advocating for citizens' assemblies, trying to activate randomly selected people, like on juries, to engage in and talk about politics in the world. And I actually think people have a lot to say and would be very happy to do it. And so programs like that, to me, would be very effective in restoring trust in government.
All right. Well, you know, that's a big problem, trust in government, trust in each other. And it's hard to see, just based on this discussion this morning and some of the things that you've all brought out, how a divided country is going to get unified again. You know, I recall all the time September 11th and what happened during that time. You know, truckloads of supplies and volunteers from places like Texas and Arizona and Utah coming to New York to help New Yorkers. And we love you, New York. And now, you know, we're all demonizing each other and we've gotten to this terrible point. And what does it take? Does it take leadership? Does it take some sort of terrible event to bring us back together? You know, what is it?
I think it takes talking with people you disagree with. I mean, I've been on a number of these roundtables. This is the first one where there's been a real disagreement that I've been at, and I think that's great. You know, I think there's a lot that Mark and I and Catherine and Kathy agree on. I think if you actually listen to a lot what we said, there's a lot that we agree on. There's some that we disagree on. And the way you rebuild trust is you actually focus on and you find the places you agree and you allow for disagreement. You allow cities to do it differently. You allow places in the country to do it differently, but you also find what you agree on. And right now, all of our institutions are focused on disagreement, right? Gerrymandering has made disagreement the absolute center. I mean, we have to deal with this problem. And I don't know how you do it, because right now both sides are gerrymandering as fast as they can, partly because I think the president has decided to make it an issue. Now, the Democrats have also gerrymandered. But we have to do that. And I do think that if you were to bring everyday citizens, randomly selected, who disagree into the process and get them talking, you would force them to not just make political points, but try and come up with solutions and find places they agreement. So why are we starting to say, like, okay, we're going to get together and we're going to talk about street, you know, traffic, or we're going to talk about healthcare. Everyone write down what would make your, you know, from 1 to 10, the best solution you could have. And they all write down, you know, this. And then I say, all right, instead of the 10, move us from 2 to 3. And that's a much more manageable solution. And that's what the kind of thing we need. We need to bring people into the process, get them talking, and have conversations like this, but in a structured way where we're actually trying to come to solutions and not just posture for disagreement.
Mayor.
I think that, you know, there are those who want us to be angry at each other and not get anything done, and they're feeding it. You know, pessimism is a very powerful tool. But we talk about, you know, and different people call it different things, but sort of the zone of productive anxiety. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when temperatures are too high, we're screaming at each other and we can't figure out a way to do exactly what you just described. But when we're complacent, then we're not motivated enough to actually bring about change. And so finding that zone of productive anxiety, I think, is really important. I think that we have a couple of opportunities that are happening organically in Albany, partially around the governor's $200 million. We had 700 people come to a public meeting and sit at tables together. And it was people from all walks of life. There were young activists that were there. There were business owners. There were small business owners. There were bankers. There were the people who work for not-for-profits and community-based organizations sitting together around tables talking about what they wanted to see for the future of Albany. It was an incredibly productive conversation. There's another meeting that's coming up in November to talk about how we then granularize that and talk about specific potential projects. And so there are opportunities to do that, but I think you're right. We as elected officials need to seize more of those, but we need to set them up in a way that we're in a zone of productive anxiety. And that is something that has been really challenged in this environment.
Well, if I were to blow the public radio horn for a moment, that's one of the places you can have these discussions, like right here on WAMC. And we've seen what's happened to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Mm-hmm. We need to have face-to-face interaction. The other side of this, which I think we all agree on, is that this social media world is not good for any of us. You get caught in your little world and your little friend group, and you're throwing bombs at everybody else, whether you're liking the ones that are against your opponent or the opposite. And that kind of thing is not good because you're seeing so many people caught up in this world where there's not this wider understanding of what's happening right now. And you can't debate that when other people are watching SpongeBob SquarePants.
Well, it's not just one. It's also the algorithms that force you into that try and upset you and try and get you mad and basically feed you stuff that makes you angry. Those algorithms are dangerous, and you know, we can't stop them. They're part of the world. But we could create incentives to for companies and for people to join social media, in which the algorithms feed them actually content that's not always just designed to make them angry or make them feel virtuous about themselves. Yeah. And there are ways to do that.
Yeah, Dave. When Facebook first came out, he said, "Great, I love to debate."
Yeah, yeah.
Because most politicians, they really don't like to debate. They want to lay low. That's been my experience.
You are so right about that.
So, but I started, and I couldn't believe the personal attacks on me I could take, but on my friends.
Yeah.
They said, "Well, I'm not going to post my opinion again," and that's what limits debate. So it's not working, because people are afraid that they're going to be attacked. And the key in politics is to not take things personally. You know, I'm a Republican who lives in a Democrat district, and I win, by 30 points. But it's not about taking things personally. It's saying, I want to test my point of view against yours and then let the people vote on it. And that's why I think this end of democracy thing is terrible rhetoric, because people are so, oh, my God, it's the end of democracy. I'm going to go out and shoot somebody. In fact, they've tried to kill Trump twice. They've tried to kill Democrats. We've really got to say, oh, I'm really mad. I don't like their positions. But then it's going to say, okay, let's argue about that. And then, as Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan's, then they went out and had a beer.
After. There is something to be said for that.
But Mark, I do think how we are treated matters as well. And so I was at a public meeting, and there were a bunch of people that were there to speak at the public meeting. And the council gives me the grace of going first. And as I was speaking, there were people who were opposed to what I was saying, and they screamed, they shouted at me, they called me horrible names, and so people took their name off the list.
Yep.
Right? And so
that's just what we're talking
about. Yeah, I mean, I agree with what you're saying.
I'm dead set against protesting somebody when they're speaking or going to their house. Yeah. I just can't stand that kind of stuff.
But I think, when we say we have thick skins, and I do have a thick skin, I think the piece of it, and this is something that's being talked about, it's a big issue in the New York Conference of Mayors about the importance of civility, because when people see us screamed at, and again, I'm an elected official, it does have an impact on people's willingness to speak out and participate in our government in civil society.
No doubt. And they're the people. The people in the middle need to weigh in, and they do. By the way, that's why this ends up not. They vote. They get to vote. They're going to vote. They're already voting already. Although I think it's crazy, we have 10 days of early voting, and sometimes one person an hour comes in on, in local elections.
Well, thank you for having early voting, because I am actually heading to Brazil to go to a climate conference with subnational leaders from all over the world, and I won't be here on election day.
But yeah,
bring back some coffee.
You could do a paper ballot, though. I mean, it's just...
It's far more convenient.
We're paying people to sit there all day long.
But it's far more
person.
Convenient for me to be able to vote. I think the more opportunities we give people to vote, the better. I did take my granddaughter with me. She misheard me. She thought I was taking her on a boat. And so when we walked out of the voting booth, she wanted to know where the boat was. Fortunately, I voted downtown. And so we just went right over to the Slater and got a little tour. So she got to vote and did go on a boat. So it was... A bonus morning
for
everyone.
Good for you.
And there were probably 10 people on a Saturday morning.
What we heard from the election commissioners the other day during a committee meeting is it's made it more convenient to vote, but it really hasn't had a big impact on increasing voting. So I think it's especially true for local elections. I mean, presidents, maybe it's different. I just think it's not an efficient use of taxpayer money because there's plenty of opportunities to vote, frankly. I like the idea of the last weekend, especially because instead of coming home from work, my wife and I like to vote together and we pick a time. And it's usually, they're pretty accessible to vote. I don't think it's hard to vote. I really don't. And I think we maybe went a little too far, but it's state law that says you've got to do all this, or else I believe there'd be a discussion in the county about, making it a little more restrictive, but at the same time, making it convenient enough that people will vote. But I don't think that's why they're not voting. Convenience isn't the issue. They're dissatisfied with the government. They don't trust anybody. They don't want to vote. And, of course, that's exactly the wrong position to take. The way to change government is to vote in a way that you think is going to make the government better.
Irene has written to the panel, "I think we are a nation that wants to come together, with the exception of some. We do come together on a local level. On a national level, we need a leader that doesn't capitalize on divisiveness. We need a leader that loves politics and working for people."
Right. Like I think everyone in this room agrees that there is great value in being able to debate without worrying about your safety or getting attacked or being called names. Like, those things are horrible. But, if we look at our leadership, Trump and others are not modeling what healthy debate looks like.
Well, he was in Korea and all of a sudden he started going off on the Fed. I mean, he just starts demonizing these American people. Well, he's going to be gone soon. So,
right.
And he's
posting.
Why would you do
these,
that in a foreign country?
And he's posting all of these like AI generated videos that continue to drive a wedge between people. Right. It creates this environment, the social environment in which we feel like, oh, it's Democrats against Republicans, it's us against them. It's that sort of animosity has to be reined in.
Well, let me just add
he nicknames
that.
Them too.
I mean, Trump, they prosecuted him. And that was something new, because it's one thing to, attack people, but to start to prosecute them. So, you understand where Trump is coming from, because they've tried to prosecute and now they've all gone away now. Who knows if they would have remained.
Well, at the end of the day, he's still president, right? So,
yeah, well, that's if you have to fear prosecution, then you're not going to get a lot of good candidates. That's for sure.
So it doesn't matter what the person did.
So it doesn't matter what they did.
Right.
So look, there is something called prosecutorial discretion, right? Mm-hmm. And there's no doubt that Trump did a lot of what he was prosecuted for. That said, I do agree. I was against the prosecutions, or at least I thought that if they were prosecuted, he should have been pardoned afterwards. We have a tradition and a system in this country that the way to deal with politicians who break the law is to not elect them back or impeach them. And those are the ways that we actually deal with it. The idea of going around and prosecuting your political enemies doesn't strike me as a very healthy way to address these kind of things in a small R Republican constitutional system. And I think that it was a mistake. I think the bigger mistake was not impeaching him, at least the second time for sure, for what he did on January 6th in 2020, which was without a doubt an impeachable offense. And I think, unfortunately, Mitch McConnell made a calculation that he would never recover, that Trump would never recover from it politically, and that the Republicans could not anger his base, not impeach him, and still keep him out of politics. And I think that was going to go down as one of the greatest miscalculations in American political
history.
What's
an impeachment anymore? I mean, he was impeached twice.
Well,
nothing happened.
Well, there's impeachment, and then there's the trial where you're convicted. You're actually kicked out of office. There's a difference. I mean, the word is confusing because you're impeached by a House, and then you have to be tried by the Senate. You know that. I mean, I'm not telling you anything you don't know.
And now he's engaged in going after all the people.
Yeah,
who
and
he
now
feels
he has a
wronged
right,
him.
He has a rightful feeling of resentment, which, you know, to some degree, and yet he's using that to justify an attempt to destroy the entire, you know, institutional framework of our justice system in this country, which is, you know, my mother and grandmother used to tell me two wrongs don't make a right. I mean, this is what he's doing out of a sense of, you know, maybe he has some grievance, and I accept that. What he's doing, taking it out against the whole country and his enemies, is not only disgusting personally, but destructive of the country.
But come on, Tish James said during her campaign, I'm going to get Trump. I saw it on videotape. I'm going to get Trump. Nothing in particular, but I'm going to get him. And she went after him. And now she's indicted for almost the same thing.
Trump said to Hillary, lock her up in 2016.
Yeah,
I mean, look, I don't like what Tish James said. I don't like what Trump said. But
well, no, he shouldn't have said that either. Yeah,
but Trump was convicted of 32 felonies.
34.
I mean, 34, sorry. You know, and these were crimes that he committed. This was fraud that was committed, not as president. This was financial fraud that he committed as a business person.
That every person in the real estate industry does, and
also,
no one gets prosecuted.
It was in Manhattan where he got
12% of the vote.
It was clearly
a political prosecution. We have to at least admit that.
Okay. Yeah. So again, this is where, you know, people, you know, you talk about picking and choosing, but for those who want all the rules to apply to all of us, we want them to apply to everyone. And so, you know, you could say that about what, you know, Martha Stewart, right? She did something that, you know, people do all the time on Wall Street.
Insider trading.
Right. Yeah. And get away with. I think you go down a slippery slope. He mm-hmm. was convicted of financial fraud, and that was a case that was prosecuted and was a successful prosecution.
Well, you know what? We're not going to get to the denouement, I don't think, because you folks are going to hold your positions tight. But I can't tell you how important it is that we have these discussions. And I was kind of lucky to get the spot to host with you guys today. It was energetic and good and good for the soul, quite frankly. So I want to thank our panel for today. And you guys, again, we're great. Roger Berkowitz, Mark Grimm, Mayor Kathy Sheehan, and Catherine Tan. Don't forget, there's always something to do in Albany. All right.
Well, part of beautiful
thanks,
Albany
David.
County.
Thanks to all you guys.
That's
this
right.
Great.
Thanks to everyone who weighed in on the panel today. Again, if you want to share any thoughts, panel at WAMC.org. We appreciate you all for being here. We're going to have to go over to a little Congo Corner coming up shortly. I'm David Gustina. Thanks for being with us.